And you actually are lowering yourself on the ground. We have half prostrations, full length. And but that idea of bowing down cuts pride and arrogance. It's very effective for that, humbling yourself. But for some people, it's heavy. They don't like to bow down. You know, so I totally get that. That's why there's no obligation. But the kids are enjoying doing. And it is interesting, too, because I was raised in a religion that you were forbidden to bow down to any idols or anything like that, what they would consider images, you know, totally forbidden. And I, you know, was on a trip to Tibet with a lot of students of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, my main teacher, a long time ago. And everybody around me was prostrating, and I was just like, you know, that ain't for me. I'm not doing that. And so then it was a big festival holiday, and we were in Lhasa in Tibet, and Rinpoche gave all his students, most of whom had been around much longer than me, I wasn't even a Buddhist then, and gave them instructions of what to do that special day, which included prostrations and all these other things, you know, reciting prayers. And so I, at one point, you know, I heard how holy the day was, and it was a big day, and, you know, and I didn't have much respect or any idea, but I decided I would try one prostration in front of the holy temple. The Jokhang Cathedral is in the center of Lhasa. If you ever get a chance to go to Tibet, you must visit that temple. It's just a precious, amazing place, even if you're not a Buddhist. And then there was like a few, and there were lots of people making prostrations, like, because it was kind of Buddhist based at the time. You know, now it's really totalitarian regime, but so all these people, because it was a holiday, came out to that. There were just tons of people. So can you imagine, you are at maybe around the Empire State Building, New York City. I'm just thinking of a big landmark. I don't know what the big landmarks are here in Raleigh, but. And you're coming up to the building or the federal building or something, and all these people are making prostrations, or your local church, and all these people are outside. You know, so in Buddhist country, it's like that. So I decided, and I had a little shawl, and the ground was all disgusting, these rocks, these stones, but I had a little shawl I put down, and there's all these old ladies near me, and they're all excited that I'm going to make a prostration. You know, like all the support. We're in our cultures. You do a prostration, everybody's going to be looking at you like, what's wrong with, you know, another crazy person. So anyway, I learned how to make a prostration, and then I did it. But I first had to look around to make sure nobody was seeing, because I thought if anyone took a photo of me and somehow that got to my parents, it would have been, you know, the worst. So, and I thought the sky might fall in, actually. I mean, it was just how I was brought up. So I made one prostration, and it was, it felt so good. So I kept doing, you know, so it was interesting. So when you are prostrating, what's another thing you might think about? These are great things that you mentioned. Yeah.
You might think about all the good things you have in your life.
Fantastic. And something else you were saying? And what you need. Yep. All the good things in your life and what you need.
Your intention.
Fantastic. These are wonderful answers. So the most important part before you start is your intention, your motivation. So, you know, I like to think I'm making a prostration because it plants positive seeds in my mind. And those seeds at some point can ripen. Like when you plant, you know, you put a seed in the ground and you see a little shoot come up. Some of you have probably done that, and you have gardens. So, if I plant a positive seed that I have a good intention, it's going to ripen in happiness for me in the future, which is great. Okay? So what if I have an intention in this tradition that this can plant a seed that gets me to a fully awakened state? You know, when you're really awake, you feel really awake and you're alive and you're sensitized to everything. But the real reason we want to do that, in a sense, to become a Buddha, is then I'm unlimited in helping all living beings. So if you want to fold that into your motivation, then every prostration is a little bit more powerful. Good. So that's one thing to think about, okay? So let's take a moment, if you want to close your eyes and just reflect on your purpose for being here. And just think if you'd like to include that motivation of reaching a place like enlightenment, full enlightenment. Why? So I can benefit all living beings as best as possible. And you want to kind of plant that like you're planting a seed for a glorious flower in your heart. And then when we make prostrations, you can open your eyes. When we make prostrations, one of the things that's really helpful, if you can visualize yourself as big as possible, because they say the more atoms of ground you cover, the more purification possible. And if you'd like and you have really good visualization, not everybody does, that's okay, you can visualize many, many numbers of yourself spreading out, multiplying. Like you just pushed a button on a copy machine and all these images of yourself go out. So this way, just one of you making a prostration, but in your mind, many, many, many of you making prostration. Make sense? Okay.
So before we do our prayers, we have a class that meets right outside this door. You might be able to hear us while you're teaching. We try to keep it quiet. The students in that class have a small thing that they've been working on. They wanted to tell you about it and then give you a copy of it. So, Evelyn.
And are these all the kids?
These are all the kids who are here today, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Didn't there used to be like twice as many? Or
yeah, I would say so.
Okay,
yeah.
No, I was just wondering what. Yeah. I miss all the kids. Happy to see all of you.
So last fall, we worked on this newsletter that we made. We produced it. We did all the work for it and put it together. And it's about the 16 guidelines, and we focused on some in particular, but we put it together, and it has all sorts of things from drawings to interviews to quizzes, and we'd like to give a copy to you today.
Wow, thank you. Oh, nice. So if you're not familiar with the 16 guidelines, thank you so much. That's very, very kind. Let me have a look at this. Some of you are familiar. The 16 guidelines deal with, in a sense, a more secular approach to, I would say, developing kindness, you know, to being kind. And it has all these really neat categories like contentment, kindness, humility, patience, you know, and they have different people that, world leaders that embody, you know, one of those things, and then they talk about how they live through it and things like that. And it's beautiful. So here on the front, they have contentment, being okay with what you have, not needing a bunch of things you don't really need, right? I mean, just that alone would be so helpful for most of the people I know in the United States, right? Including myself. You know, so when you think about contentment, which is a wonderful place to operate from, you know, are you okay? Don't you have enough stuff? I'm just talking about stuff now. Don't we have enough stuff? And can you be happy with what you've got? You know, it's not exactly. So not really. So if you get this message early, it sounds like you guys already got it. I noticed my niece is 26 years old, and she's great. She's already got this mode of, you know, she got into the, some of you have watched the Marie Kondo videos. Anyway, I read the book a few years ago, this Art of Tidying Up. Okay? Read it a few years ago. I was trying to help a couple hoarders that I know. One of them I actually tried to gift the book, and they were like, no, I'm not ready for that yet. No, I know about the book, but I'm not ready. Please, you know, don't, like, it stressed them out just to have the book in their possession. So my niece started watching, and she's already kind of gone through some of the exercises at 26, which is great because that's when you start accumulating stuff and thinking, I got an apartment and I'm going to get a bigger apartment. So if you already get it at a younger age, and if it's kind of like if you get a new sweatshirt at some point and your old sweatshirt was fun and you loved it and you did all this stuff in it, but now it's got holes and it's stained and you're really not going to wear it again. If I get a new sweatshirt in, can I move an old sweatshirt out? And you just end up with less stuff to deal with, and possibly as you get older, less things that are weighing on your mind. Like then you end up with like, I have to clean that closet out, and it sits there over and over, the basement or the attic. And here's another thing of kindness. Some people wrote, in my opinion, kindness is the most important guideline. I think I would agree with that. Kindness could be helping someone, talking to someone if they are sad or angry, or just being a nice person. That's really sweet. That's wonderful. So this is this lovely, and on the back they have, it's like a postcard. Always choose kind. Always choose kind. Kindness, helping someone, caring for all beings, just being nice, comforting someone. They have generosity listed here, honesty, patience, contentment. This is fantastic. Thank you so much. This is lovely. I will cherish this. And here's a survey. What does patience mean to you? What does patience mean? So Kai conducted the survey, it looked like. Oh, Kai, there you are, hiding from me because I kind of pinned him into a corner yesterday with some heavy questions. What does patience mean to you? This is interesting. These are seven situations about patience. I'm going to read to you. I want you to tell me which one got the highest amount of people felt like this is what patience was. Waiting, stillness, Hufflepuff. I think it's from Harry Potter. I don't exactly know what that means. Is a house. I thought it was a house. I read the books. But nobody selected that one. I'll give you a clue. No one selected Hufflepuff as far as patience. Peacefulness, calmness, restraint, self-control. Which got the most votes? Wait, but do you already know the answer?
No, they were in a different
class. So let me,
Hufflepuff.
Hufflepuff? I'm afraid not. It didn't get any.
I think it's what, the last one? The last one?
Self-control?
Yes. Yeah,
you think it was that one?
Yeah.
Anybody else have any thoughts? Waiting, stillness, peacefulness, calmness, restraint, self-control. They're not saying anything. Now what do I do? Okay. So this is interesting. No.
I support her answer.
Okay. I mean, that was the answer. Self-control seemed to get the most. Peacefulness, nothing. That's kind of interesting. But this is interesting.
It seems like it would be
calmness. Calmness also? Yeah, it could be. That got less than self-control.
I would say stillness or
because self-control is kind of cool because in Tibetan, the real explanation of patience, the real meaning of it in Tibetan from the Tibetan language is bearing up under harsh circumstances. So it's not just about waiting. It's actually in the face of adversity. You know, somebody's in your face and really challenging you and you don't like it. How are you doing? Or you have circumstances around you that are really trying on you right now. That's patience, when you can find a balanced state of mind in that situation. So that it's really correct self-control. I think it's really a good one to have it. And I like below that they have a picture of all these photographs. What we have is enough, it says. And think about it, of do we have enough? Can you be happy with what you have? Because then you have a much better peace of mind. And so be very careful as you guys are growing up. What you're going to find is, and you know what, why don't you sit up? Because it's better that you sit up in a gompa. It's really the proper way to sit. It's better for your mind. So when you're growing up, if you get it early on that you actually probably have a lot of things, and you can think about people that don't have anything near what you have, can I be a little bit more satisfied? Because what happens is advertisers are going to prey on you. If any of you watch TV with commercials, they know just how to get you. So that then you're going to run to your parents, I need the thing, I saw it on TV. Right? Does that ever happen? You know. And then sometimes you see a friend of yours has something that you don't have, and then you run to your parents, so-and-so has this, I want it. So when you get older, it gets more sophisticated. Okay? So now adults, if they watch television with commercials, they are subject to all of the pharmaceutical ads. This, in my area, it's like that. So then they run to their doctor and they go, I want the thing because I saw it on TV. I don't want pain because I can't deal with the least little discomfort. Sometimes we're uncomfortable a little bit. So patience is, you know, I'm really actually okay. I can live with this, something like that. But we have enough stuff. So it's interesting to watch your mind when they invent the new toy, the new updated version of the toy. When, as you get a little older, it's going to be a smartphone like that. And, you know, if your smartphone is working and doing everything you want it to do, is that okay?
Yeah.
Great. Wonderful. You'll be happier. Because what happens is then you see this guy's doing it and it goes faster and this one does this and this one goes to the bathroom for you and it does all these things, right? And then you want it, and then what happens is people I know got the new smartphone. They wanted it bigger. Then they started complaining to me, well, now it doesn't fit in my pocket, and it's too big. I can't put my finger across the screen for the thing, and then they don't know how to work it. So one of my friends, we were trying to have a meeting, and every 10 minutes there was this boop, boop, going, and he didn't know how to shut it off. Like, it was just, so it's a nice quality to be satisfied with what you have. Do you have any questions for me? Anything else? Yes.
Where did you get the idea of something going to the bathroom for you?
Well, so my thing is, I have a phone. I'm very grateful to these other people offered to me with the plan. I'm very grateful to them, and I'm satisfied. It's a little bit older phone. It's fine. But when I will upgrade is when I find a phone that will go to the bathroom for me. That would be that, because that, you know, sometimes when you have to go to the bathroom and you're on long road trips, it can interrupt things. So I'm looking for that kind of phone. That phone will be really smart.
Yeah.
Sure. Wait, hang on. She's got the microphone.
How come Hufflepuff didn't get any single vote?
I don't know. You might have to ask
Hufflepuff.
Kai about that. You might have to ask Kai, because he did the survey.
So we were having a little fun with it, just like...
Yeah.
But it must have been a machine if it was going to be a phone that could, like, transform into a toilet to go to the bathroom. Or you'd have to have a car, and you could press a button, and it turned into a toilet.
Well, that would be interesting. Okay. Okay, I've opened up a whole other door of possibilities.
So with social media today and, like, kids having smartphones and all, like, how is it okay to, like, stay moral and to, like, what we can try to be kind online? Like,
yeah,
how
so
can
great,
we do that?
Great question. Thank you for I planted her there to say that. So one thing that is, this is really important for you guys, honestly. I can't say this enough. So everybody listening? You're all there? Okay. So I don't know, what age do kids get phones generally?
Middle school.
Middle school, okay. Yes, middle school. Okay, this is my role when you get phones. This is probably why it's good I'm not a parent. 28 years old. I don't see any point having a phone before you're 28, you know.
I would have a phone without 5 years old.
And the reason is, so this is what happens. And you've seen, you know, I know you see your parents on it. You see adults. You see older siblings, family members, cousins. But you're going to end up, now I have books on my phone, so I teach from my phone. Okay, so there's some constructive things I believe our technology can do. And there's some destructive things. You have to be honest with yourself. Okay, you're all good thinkers. You're smart. But you're going to be spending a lot of time I call it in the box. So when I was your age, and really for quite some years, teen years, whatever, we didn't have this, as you know. We had a different box. It was called television. And that was also equally like a numbifier. You get numb. Okay? And what happens, this box is more sophisticated and the whole world is in this box and it comes through to you. So, but what happens is I was outside with my friends, playing in the street, all kinds of things. I grew up in front of a woods. We were climbing trees. We had forts. We were sledding in the woods. We were hiking in the woods. We had a stream. We played with little animals in the woods, and it was fantastic. It was really fun. And we had all this kind of outdoor time, breathing fresh air, personally interacting with each other, so we learned kind of how to get along with each other. And honestly, what I've noticed is when you're in the box, it's not like that. So there's a study, and we've got some students in the back of the room from, is it a college or? Yeah, okay. So also, because you guys are in the midst of it too, you might notice. So there's one school, I may have mentioned this last time, their sociology department, this is in a university, they did a 2-week course with the students, no technology for 2 weeks. So I think they took their phone, they really made it strict. No computer, no phone, no social media, no going to the library to work on a computer, 2 weeks, and they had to record things. How much exercise they got, how they did in their all their classes, what kind of social interactions they had, how much they slept, how were their social interactions, what other things that they did, how were their grades, how on and on and on. Like, it was a very elaborate survey. And obviously, you kind of know what I'm going to say, is all the things that were healthy improved, like hugely. Like the amount of exercise they got, they ate better, they said they slept better, they were, and here's the bottom line, they were all happier. So a lot of people in teens and 20s seem to suffer from anxiety and depression. This is like a plague. Okay, but this is the thing, you be stronger, you be kind of internal warriors. Okay, it means, and like a bodhisattva warrior, you're not going to war with anybody, but you're going to war with negative habits in yourself, you know, but in a peaceful way. Never harming yourself. Never, ever. There's no point. There's no point, okay? But what happens is you might end up with a core group of people, especially in middle school, and there's peer involvement. So if you've got a number of friends that are kind of into this habit of it's cool to be depressed, it's cool to be anxious, you know, we're all like that. And if you're kind of like, what? And, you know, there's nothing to be depressed about particularly. But people get into this mode like, oh, this is what's cool now. This I heard from a 20-year-old, somebody in their 20s, that and other people were. So you don't have to, you can be stronger than that to say there's, why not be happy? There's a lot of younger people super happy, and they're doing unbelievably beautiful things on the planet right now, helping people, and they're very happy as a result. So it's tricky. You really have to be strong to go against the grain when there's groups of people kind of, you know, this is our trend now. Like, it doesn't mean that the trend is a healthy trend, healthy thing to do. But so these students found that without all the technology, they were a lot happier and more productive and more peaceful, everything. And then as soon as the thing was over after 2 weeks, because it's a strong habit, they were back in the box. Like, it is a habit. A lot of us are addicted to our phones and our technology. So be strong. You know, I like now, I don't know how many of you have this, but there's a new, when I upgraded just the system, it put a thing on my phone called screen time. Does anybody have screen time? It tells me how much I use the phone. Yeah, great. So what I love is when it pops up with this little thing that says, you use 12% less than last week. I'm always like, you know, thank you. Like, so now granted, you know, there are things you use it for. If you're traveling, there's certain things, but can you limit the junk you're doing on your phone? Can you try to limit? And a lot of you play computer games, I take it. And so again, like, this is a new generation of people, and you sit with a friend in front of a computer screen, but you're really individually playing. So you kind of play against each other, but it'd be neat to balance your time. Could you, as much time you go on the screen, can you have as much time, if it's a nice day, taking a walk in nature? Because usually people feel happier. Please check yourself. You have to check. But I've noticed that myself when I just go out for a walk, and you got fresh air, and my mind gets expansive with fresh air. and I start noticing other things. And so if you can, you're kind of at the beginning of this phase of it, you could be pretty strong about it and I think lead satisfying lives. Make sense? Possible? So I think that I don't know, you guys could comment from the back of the room that it seems that, and this is from some of my friends in their 20s, that too much screen time, they say, contributes to anxiety and depression. Experience, you have that experience in the back? Yeah, they're kind of nodding. So because the other thing is, you go on here and then you see something that other friends are posting. And sometimes it's something you wanted to do, but you're not doing it. And then you get sad. And then you feel like, well, how come she's doing it? You know, it becomes like that you should. So people start lowering their self-image. If you hadn't looked at it, you're the same person. You're perfectly fine the way you are. You know, certainly if you want to improve, you can improve, but not because I'm competing with somebody else. And I think that the phone tends to keep those things. And then you end up looking at stuff in the world that, you know, maybe you don't like seeing and things like that. So, yes.
That sounds a lot like contentment.
Contentment, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very astute. Contentment. You know, where you just realize I'm actually okay. So, and be skillful. The other thing that this does is it starts tracking you. It knows more and more about you by how you use your phone. So if you happen to look on your phone for a really cool pair of red shoes, okay, you know, but if you look on your phone and you didn't put it in a private mode of looking, then ads start popping up trying to sell you red shoes. Okay, not only is it distracting, it's garbage I don't need because I already got the shoes, I'm done, it's, you know, finished, but it starts, and so ad people are the best psychologists. They know just how to get you. And they're going to keep reminding you until you go, oh, well, they're on sale. You know, I should get two pairs. You know, it's like so that desire is going to grab you, and you don't have to give in to it. So you can be more skillful that I don't need those kind of things. I'm not going to be looking at sites like that. Comes up, it just becomes a distraction, and you start believing I need another fleece vest. You know, I need another pair of that. I need, because it's, so it is a level of, this is what your mind's being imprinted with, okay, as opposed to, it'd be neat if, you know, nice little sayings and thoughts like you guys wrote is what was coming up on my phone. If there was a reminder, and you can have things like that on your phone, a reminder comes up, kindness, a reminder comes up, contentment, you know, and then motivation. Oh, did I think about living beings today? Oh, that would be a good thing to think about. You know, so you have to be very skillful. Anything else?
What's it? Okay, go ahead.
The question is, well, it's not really a question; it's a comment. Sometimes I kind of, when my mom hurts my feelings, it always happens. It happens with everyone. I kind of try to write her notes because, like, she will not let me just walk up to her and go, Mommy, blah, 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 blah. So I just have to somehow figure out how to send her a note, which is a lot of work. And I sometimes send it to her in reminders.
And do you send her a nice note?
I'm like, Mommy, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, because you have to know, too, that you're... Your parents are doing the best they can, you know, and all of the parents, many of your parents here, I know that parents go to they've all gone to that, you know, Harvard of parenting school, right? And that's called, they learned how to do it from their parents who went to that school. So this is what's amazing is parenting to me, which is one of the most good parenting, one of the most valuable things to do on the planet, right? There's no education for it.
Oh, boy.
There's no formal education for how to be a good parent. It's amazing. So your parents are doing the best they can. And parents sometimes need space, you know, like that. So it's understandable to want to, it's nice to write a nice note and sometimes thank your parents for what they're doing instead of waiting until you're 38 to do it, because then you have your own kids and you go, oh my God, I can't believe what they put up with. Please.
So, you know how you were talking about technology and the ads? So, there's this show called, Magic for Humans, and there's this guy that, it was so creepy. So, they wanted stuff on the internet, and they were looking it up. So, this drone came in, and he had a package, and so the guy asked them what they would want, and they said fresh tomato, batteries, flowers, and a bunch of other stuff. So they dropped the box, and inside, without even knowing it, the box had flowers, batteries, and fresh tomatoes. So they instantly know it's creepy. And the episode was about how technology is getting stronger and stronger.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't expect in my lifetime I'd be living in a science fiction movie. Sometimes I feel that way. Like that. Yeah, that's interesting.
I think we also want to make sure we save time for all the grown-ups who came.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's yes.
But we usually leave after the prayers, so if that helps you with the next transition.
Oh, yes. So I forget we were going to do the prayers. So let's do that. And thank you again for this lovely, wonderful newsletter. So we're going to go to the gold prayer book.
Page 34.
That's right, page 34. Shakyamuni Buddha mantra, we're going to do three times. You guys are pretty familiar with this mantra, right? Yeah. And great, and he's already reminded me, it's really nice if you'd like, you can put your hands like this. And so when we do this mudra, it's a mudra of prostration, I'm just paying respect. You don't have to do, but we put the thumbs inside, like the jewel in the lotus. So the thumbs aren't empty, like a yoga posture. There's actually always something there, like an offering. Oh, tayata, om mune, mune, maha mune, soha. Tayata, om mune, mune. Maha mune soha. Tayata om mune mune. Maha mune soha. The Medicine Buddha, Bhagawan with equal compassion for all, whose names when merely heard dispels the suffering of the lower realms, dispeller of disease and the three poisons, I prostrate to Medicine Buddha Lapis Light. Tayata om bekanze bekanze maha bekanze bekanze ranze samungate soha. Tayata om bekanze bekanze maha bekanze bekanze ranze samungate soha. Tayata om bekanze bekanze maha bekanze bekanze ranza samungate soha. Three times? Four immeasurables. These are prayers we're going to send out to the universe. They're immeasurable based on the number of beings we're sending them to that are countless. But also it would be nice to send out immeasurable love is what they represent, immeasurable compassion, freedom from suffering, immeasurable joy, kind of ultimate happiness, and immeasurable equanimity, treating all beings with equal respect, equal regard. So also, I mentioned this before, these, in, particularly in this order, these lines, Simchen Tenje Dwa Dang, in Tibetan. So has anyone seen The Return of the Jedi? Okay. So I know in the original version, I'm not sure it's in the digitized version, but at the end, the Ewoks are chanting this prayer in Tibetan. You can recognize it clear as day. So if you're a big filmmaker who is Buddhist, like George Lucas, you can disseminate this worldwide, the Four Immeasurables, and it leaves an imprint, positive imprint in people's minds. So let's send this out to everybody. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. All sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And the Tara Mantra, how many times? Page 37 at the bottom. Chenrezig's Mantra. This is the Buddha of Infinite Compassion. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. And below that, Green Tara's Mantra. This is Green Tara over here. And there's all these Taras here with a green one of the statue. Right in the front, the small statue. Om Tare Tutare Ture Soha. 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 Om Tare. Tu tare tu re 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 soha. Om tare. Tutare ture 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 soha. Om tare. Tu tare tu re 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 soha. Do you guys not know the mantra?
We just say it a little differently.
Oh, do you? Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Om Tare Tu, Tare Tu, and so.
Okay. Yeah, there's different tunes.
As far as you, and you can't recover.
It's true. That's true. So thank you. Thank you very, very much. I mean, do we want a photo with the kids, or do we? Do you want to do a photo? I'd love a picture with you guys, with my book. So why don't you come and squeeze in? We can have somebody here, some kids over here. This is great. Maybe some more people on this side. A few people on this side. Oh, that looks good. Yeah, come on in. Any other kids? You want to come in?
All right, we'll take a couple of shots on three.
Oh, wait, we have more kids coming. More are coming.
More.
Anybody else?
No.
No, no? Okay. Do you mind if your kid is maybe publicized? Might be on my website or something. Okay. Okay.
All right, so we'll take shots on three. One, two, three. Just try to keep your eyes open. One, two, three. There we are.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Lovely to meet all of you, to see all of you. Enjoy your day. If people have questions to better focus or tailor a teaching for you. So I was kind of interested in, I think some people were going to. And anything, even in the back of the room, anything about Buddhism?
Yeah, basic question. In the last two.
Can you wait and use the microphone because people are streaming?
Do they have a reason? Are they real words or mm-hmm. they're just sounds that you have to interpret?
Sometimes it's in Sanskrit, generally. So I always wanted to know what they meant. You know, we want to know every word of it. And fair enough, right? So generally the mantras on some level mean similar things. You know, you're paying receipt for more suffering. And on a higher level, it's all trying to remind you about your way and the view. To know specifically system. So there's kind of a network that runs through your body that's not something you have faith in. If somebody's given you the mantra to say, you have some level of some positive effects in your mind. So a lot of it has to do with our faith, and this is hard for a lot of people in the West. We don't have a lot of them, but my own faith, the way it's worked, is I sought some advice from, let's say, Lama, but I asked a little question because students said, don't ask Rinpoche unless you plan to follow the advice. On this trip with his big group to Tibet. And I had a whole other trip planned. I just said, now I'm interested in Tibet. I want to know what's best. Tibet. And unique and extraordinary. I didn't have any questions. A year later, I had another opportunity to meet him. And again, I asked another symbol. If I'm doing mantras, I feel like once it's been given to me in the right lineage, and I feel I have faith that it does work, and I've noticed, you know, my baby level, because it brings wisdom, like that. Chenrei purpose. And I mentioned, like, if you're, you know, the Tara mantra, that particular mantra tends to eliminate obstacles. And there are times I teach a lot there for our center in New York, and they're in Brooklyn. You know, I'm like, I go, but better for me to go back to that than you see, oh, I just never around a block and look for a parking space. Not with on the mind. So they're always useful. And some people that, we're talking about mind training and say are mundane or whatever, could be brushing your teeth or getting dressed, but then you're at work and now you're irritated by this person. So instead of getting into some normal mind or mantra that kind of can settle it a little, I might still be irritated, but if suddenly I'm like, I'm noticing the irritation and then immediately that triggers me to start, Om Mani Padme, Om Mani Padme, Om Mani Padme. It's much better for the mind to develop a pattern like that. Then normally you get irritated with somebody at work, and maybe you have a habit of, then I go to my coworker that I'm really close with, and then we gossip about that person. And does that really make you feel better? First of all, it doesn't resolve anything between you and the person. They're still irritating. But I find if I say mantras instead, it's better for my speech karma. Less gossip, less divisive speech, and a little bit more calming for the mind. So we try to establish habits like that, and mantras can be helpful for that.
Is there a mantra or a practice that you recommend for people that struggle with, like, anxiety and depression as far as just every day if you get, like, panic attacks or just struggle with that?
Yeah, the mantra of the Buddha of compassion is really helpful. Compassion for yourself, you know, visualizing, like, light rays coming into yourself. And then I was so glad she didn't ask me for, like, a mantra so she could come back as a cat, right? Because Geshe Gelug was telling me once some years ago, I asked him, he came to our center in Vermont, where I used to be, to visit. And he had been here about 11 years at the time. And so he said to me, I said, Geshe-la, it must have been really hard when you first came. It's a very different culture than the monastery in South India, obviously, right? Different country. And I said, it must have been very hard. And then he looked at me and he, with his, you know, his eyes got very round. He said, oh, yes. You know, and then he told me that, well, I hope they're not here, but he said a student asked and when he first got here and said, could you give me a mantra to come back as a cat? Because the Tibetans would see that as, you know, horrible to come back as a cat. So he said it was really different, the culture. And so the Buddha of Compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om is an opener for most mantras. Hum is a closer. And it's like amen, in a sense. So Mani is jewel. Padme is the way it's spelled. P-A-D-M-E. Padme is lotus. But the Tibetans pronounce it Padme. So either way is fine. Okay? So in a sense, if you want some sort of definition of that mantra, it's, you know, in a sense, like the all of the universe is like a jewel in the lotus of my heart. That's, so you're kind of, because it's about freeing others from suffering, it's bringing that big heart to all people's suffering, and you can also bring it to your own suffering. Medicine Buddha, this is the blue Buddha next to you. So a great healing mantra, and we just recited some this morning on page 36 or something in the book, 34. The Medicine Buddha mantra, short or long, is really helpful because it's really an antidote to imbalance and dis-ease like that. So that would be also really helpful, and I think any of them could be helpful. The Tara mantra as well, Shakyamuni Buddha mantra. And what you're trying to do is imagine that aspect of the Buddha, if it's Tara, if it's Buddha of compassion, you know, or just Shakyamuni Buddha is in the space in front of you. So you feel anxious or depressed, which is common for a lot of people now. Some people have had it for years. But imagine you have a virtuous friend out there. So when we're anxious or depressed or we have trouble, we run to our friends and family, right? And you know, perfectly fine. You want some support, some comfort. You know, these are the people you're most familiar with. So are they enlightened? Right? They're limited. Their mind's limited. So if you run to them and ask for help, they'll give you a certain temporary level of support. But if I turn to Shakyamuni Buddha, who is omniscient, all-knowing, like that. I might not feel that familiar to the images of the Buddha, the Tara, but through the practice you get more familiar and they become the people you turn to. Not exactly that you're seeing a live Buddha in front of you, but they say if you just visualize there is somebody good that comes. You know, now you're not going to really see them, but you have an experience. And then imagine light rays coming from that emanation, whomever you're visualizing. Maybe you have trouble visualizing, so maybe green tar is a green light, emerald green light out there. Maybe Shakyamuni Buddha, a golden radiance coming to you and driving away all the depression and anxiety.
Thank you.
You can try a little bit like that. It's hard. It's hard. And know that depression and anxiety is not the true nature of your mind, and it's impermanent. Those situations change. And there probably was there a time you can remember before anxiety and depression? So that's in your mind, too, that it wasn't always there.
Venerable Amy, I hope this isn't a personal question. If it is, you just please disregard it. But I'm very curious to know, at what point did you make this very major decision to ordain?
Yeah, you can ask me personal questions.
Thank you.
So I was 41 when I ordained, and I had been living and working at Buddhist centers for some years. So I think I'd been around the Dharma maybe around 13 years. Yes, I'd already been around, and my whole life was just moving more and more into that direction. I had a number of friends ordained, and I used to think about ordination, you know, at times in my kind of Buddhist career. But then I'd be in and out of a relationship, and I'd be like, okay, you know, another boyfriend or another, you know. So I'd kind of be like, well, maybe not this life. But so I started thinking, if I was meant to ordain, if that was best for me, could I clear the obstacles, whatever they were? You know, it wasn't anything specific, but could I clear the obstacles to really do it if it was the best way for me to lead my life, most beneficial thing for me to do? And I think you have to, I mean, they say you need a lot of merit to get ordained, to stay ordained. I'm not kind of boasting like I have a lot of merit, you know. It's not like that, but it's kind of protecting your mind if you're noticing, for me, living at the centers, running these centers, being in that kind of Buddhist environment most of the time, I thought it felt like it had a really positive effect on my mind. So I wanted more of it. You know, and anytime you're really happy and you feel like you're in sync, you're exactly where you need to be, and it's got a really big purpose, a good meaning, you try to direct yourself into having more of that. So I started thinking when I was working, first visiting the centers and working a regular job for a magazine, and I was visiting one center, and I kept thinking, I really like being at the center. How can I be here more? So then later, some years later, they asked me to be the director, and I went. So my whole life was kind of in that direction. So then I had a boyfriend, and I introduced him to Rinpoche, and we were living together in a small cabin at the center. So he was asked to be the second attendant for Lama Zopa Rinpoche at that point, before Rinpoche had a couple of Nepali attendants. They needed extra help. And as a lay person, he was asked to be this attendant, which was very unusual at the time. And so that was a big shock for me, because in a sense, I had talked to Rinpoche about Brian, because Brian had all these wonderful skills that would be helpful. And so what the real qualified teacher does is they set you up to make an offering. Like, you know, he basically, when I moved to the center to be the director, which Rinpoche had asked me to do, and I didn't really want to do it, but I knew it was the best thing for me to do. The day I moved there, I met Brian. So it was like Rinpoche offered me him to help. I mean, unconsciously, like indirectly, but it seemed like that. And then some years later, I you know, Rinpoche, they were looking for a second attendant. It was difficult to find the right person. I knew Brian had all these skills, and it wasn't for me to offer Brian, but I just said to Rinpoche, please consider Brian. He's got all these skills, and, you know, and then Rinpoche was so cute. And then we were at Laodo in the holy cave. It was such a precious time. And then Rinpoche said to me, after I said, Brian is, you know, and then Rinpoche said, does he know computers? He was just toying with me, playing with me. So Brian then became an attendant for a year or so, which meant that he traveled with Rinpoche, like for a few months, and then he'd come back. And when he'd come back, he would only be with me for a couple of days. And he'd come home, and usually he just needed sleep. So, because Rinpoche doesn't really sleep much. So he'd come back, and I could kind of feel that the relationship was changing somehow, that he was getting more, then he wanted to get ordained. Okay? He started to want to get ordained. And I wasn't really ready, you know, but I didn't want to stop him. And he asked me, and I said, if you want to, you know, even when he became attendant, he asked me, and I said, I think you have to do it. It's the best job. It's a very unique job if you're on a spiritual path to attend a great master like that. So then he wanted to get ordained, and then you have couple karma. Then he wanted to get ordained with me. But for me, I had to be clear that I wasn't ordaining because he was ordaining, because then it wouldn't really be a good point. So I thought about it. There's my wonderful friend. Lovely to see you, Jumpel. Oh, I'm so happy you came. I so wanted to see you. As you know, Jumpel is a very, a master artist, really, incredibly skilled artist, who made the beautiful stupa here. But he helped me at Milarepa Center with many, many glorious things that are still there. The stupa decorations, an offering room that is gorgeous with the altar, it's amazing. So then he wanted to get ordained, a couple's karmas. Then Chödön Rinpoche came to the center, who was a Vinaya master of the ethical conduct of monks and nuns. And Lama Zopa was at the center. So we had these two major beings at the center. And it was a really interesting story. So we were hosting a big retreat with a lot of people for, I don't know, six or seven weeks. And I was the director of center organizing. So we had a group, one day we had a group of people that we're going to do what's called the fire puja at the end of the retreat, which means there's all these substances that have to be washed, like grains, and wood has to be prepared. And so I had a group of people doing that. We had a long life ceremony. So this is all morning, 4 hours, a ceremony for Chödön Rinpoche that was a huge mass of things to organize. And then Lama Zopa Rinpoche lobbed on top in the afternoon before the fire puja, you should do another special long ceremony of 1,000 offerings to Maitreya, the Buddha of loving kindness. So it was kind of an unusual day. And it was Sakadawa. So it was a big holiday. It was the full moon of this major holiday. You can't imagine. It was the best day of my life. I think it was one of the best days of my life. So what happened is, shortly coming into this, there were two public ordinations. One was 2 weeks before and one was 4 weeks before, with Chödön Rinpoche, because he was very special. And three people got ordained in each ordination, but they were public, which doesn't happen. People could watch them, and it's very unusual. So sometimes I think this is the real conspiracy theory. These lamas were really trying to get me into robes, indirectly. Like, when I look back, I go, how kind of them to set this whole thing up for me to get into robes. It wasn't just me and others, but really there was so much going on for me. So what happened is, there was first an ordination, and then Brian started. He used to make kind of rash decisions. He goes, I think I want to get ordained. I have robes here, and there's an ordination later today, and I think I'm going to do it. And then I was kind of like, there goes my boyfriend, So the attachment, right? But I wanted him. I wasn't going to get in the way of him doing it. It was such a good thing to do. I'm like, look, it's. So then he said, well, you're going to be here. And I had to teach a class in town that particular evening. So I said, no, I have to go in. So I went in town, and 20-minute drive on a dirt gravel road, mountain road, to get to the main road. I'm driving to do this class, and I'm driving, and sorry, this is such a long story. And so by the end of the 20 minutes, when I got to the road, thinking about, when I come back, my boyfriend's going to be a monk. Celibate, like no more relationship with me on that level. Intimate relationship finished. And we'd been living together in this little, so 20 minutes, and at first I was sad and I was kind of emotional, and then I was happy for him. And then I thought, what am I going to do? Am I going to start all over with somebody else? Like, it seems so exhausting to me. Like, I was already like, what are you going to do? I'm like, so some renunciation for me coming up. When I look back, renunciation is when you get tired of, a certain habit that's really not benefiting you anymore. So I started thinking. So by the time I got to the road, I felt like pretty close to getting ordained. I come back that night, he's not ordained. Okay? He did somehow, and I'm like, what? My mind's like, banger, banger, what happened? And he's like, I don't know. I didn't, it didn't happen for me. But three people got ordained, not him. Second ordination comes 2 weeks later. A couple of my friends getting ordained. Anyway, things, and he starts again. I want to get ordained. Now I have a really bad cold. Really bad cold. And I didn't get to watch the first ordination. So he's really pressing on me. Come on, we should do this. And finally, I kind of snap at him. And I said, look, I don't feel well. I got a really bad cold. I have a really bad cold, and I want to watch the ordination. I want to see what goes on, I mean, I know what the vows are. Some of my friends talk to me about the vows and their lifestyle, but I wanted to see. So I watched that one. He didn't get ordained. And I thought, that's it, because to have two ordinations a couple weeks apart, it's unusual to have it like that many ordinations. And so then about a week almost a couple weeks later, Sakadawa was coming. I think it's the next day, and so I'm sitting in our office with one very close friend who had gotten ordained a couple of years before on Sakadawa with her husband at the time. And she and I in this office, was because there were so many people at the center, you'd never find yourself alone with one person in the office. There were constantly people in and out. For half an hour, nobody came in. And she's telling me about how her ordination happened, what happened, and somehow at the end of the half-hour conversation, my mind was like I felt as ready as possible. Like all of a sudden I'm like, so you have all these conditions that are helping you practice virtue. I'll say that way. Even if you're a lay person, you have many conditions you can pay attention to so that you're on a path that's leading you to be happier, happier, happier. And you have other conditions that are going to lead you away from that, right? So it's really what kind of choices you're making every moment. So as soon as this half hour, the door opens and Brian comes in, of all people, and he comes in right when I'm having this kind of moment of like, and he comes up and to me and he says, I was at the stupa and I just got this feeling that I need to get ordained. I could see myself ordained. And I looked at him and I said, okay. And he's like, are you ready? So we went to ask Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who was in the upstairs office. We went in and then Rinpoche said, I had obstacles or something, but we should go and ask Chödön Rinpoche at the little house. We went over there with Rinpoche translating for us. How kind is that? My teacher translating for me, right? Just the two of us. We sit on the floor and it's Rinpoche, me, and Brian. Chödön Rinpoche's on the bed. I can remember it like it was yesterday, right? So Chödön Rinpoche is a very still, very formal lama. And so Rinpoche translates about us getting, and we wanted to do it the next day, Sakadawa, about taking robes the next day. So the lamas talk, and then it comes for me. No, I think Brian asked first, and then Chödön Rinpoche said, is it more beneficial? And he said, well, it's beneficial if you ordain, and it's beneficial if you don't. So we're kind of like, you know, now what do we do? Like, you know, it's like each thing. So technically, you're supposed to ask three times to get ordained. Technically. I mean, you don't have to, but so that was kind of the first ask. And then, so then Brian's sitting there, not sure what to say. And then Rinpoche looks at me. And then I said about, you know, again, just reiterating, the first ask, is it possible to take robes tomorrow? And then he says to Chödön Rinpoche, and Chödön Rinpoche says, I have obstacles. So now I'm like, you know, when somebody tells you you can't do it, you have obstacles, then you want to do it. You know, I'm like, what do you mean? You know, and so then I actually said, but the nice thing is I wanted to make sure my mind really wanted it for the right reasons, because it would deepen my path, help me get enlightened more quickly to benefit all living beings. Well, you know, it's not because Brian wants to do it or doesn't want to do it. So then right away, fortunately, another positive seed ripening. And right away I said, is there anything I can do to clear the obstacles? I could have just sat back and went, I have obstacles, done. Okay, not happening. But something, again, impelled, like something, is there anything I can do to clear obstacles? Chödön Rinpoche comes back with, you can read the 8,000 verses. So what that is, it's a longer text on emptiness. I can't read it overnight. It's impossible, right? So I get that back, and I have a little bit of like, wah, wah, you know, in me of like, this isn't going to be easy. And then, again, the kindness of the qualified guru. Lama Zopa Rinpoche seated on the same level as me, which was a little uncomfortable, next to me, leans into me, and he says, so you can read, or you can have monks read. Okay? Little hint. So I'm sitting on the floor. I know everybody's like, the plot thickens. Like, I'm sitting on the floor, and now the wheels are turning here. I'm like, the monks read, and it's, you know, it's afternoon, it's... And then the lamas go on talking about a Tibetan text in Tibetan for 10 minutes. Just with the two of us sitting there. And so I start thinking, right now I'm in California. It's Sakadawa morning at Kopan. It's already, the day started for them, the big holiday. So I thought, if I could email them now, maybe somebody would get the email. You know, I don't know if they're even checking email, but there's people that work in the office. I could send the email, and maybe somebody would start reading. Like, because sometimes you just start something Rinpoche advises, and that's a huge purification. So I thought, I wonder, and so I'm thinking this, I don't know what Brian was thinking, something about, should he ask again? And then the lamas stop, and then Rinpoche looks at me, and then I said, and he said, is there anything else? And I said, and so then Brian, they look at us, and they said, anything else? And Brian said, well, I'm not really clear about, am I ordaining tomorrow? Am I not? And then Chödön Rinpoche said, yeah, good. Okay, so that was done for him, you know. I'm like, what am I, chopped liver over here? You know, like, well, I'm like, But I had my own obstacles. So then suddenly it was done. Brian's going to ordain, sitting on the floor, and it's almost, you could see the karma shifting where Rinpoche starts to get up. Like, it's over. The interview's over. And Rinpoche starts to get up, and all of a sudden I said, Rinpoche? And he sits down really forcefully, and he leans into me, and he's like, yes. like he's like, did I get it? Like, is that what's right? Is that karma ripening? Or is it some other karma ripening? Is it that karma ripening? Can you keep your mind focused on virtue a little longer? So then I said, if it's possible, could I email Kopan now? And would that be enough to clear obstacles for me taking robes tomorrow, for somebody to start reciting? And he sends that over, translates it over to Chidam Rinpoche, who gets a big smile on his face, and he says, hey, yes. Yeah. So it was so amazing. And so the next day we were in robes, like that. So it was very special. It was a very special time, and some of it was very humorous, because we were there at the center the next day until 4 p.m. And it was, as I mentioned, all these things happening, it was phenomenally busy. You know, I'd gotten up at, we started the day at 4. So I already was on 12 hours with all the setup for all these pujas, and I mean, it was massive amount of stuff. And Sogyal Rinpoche visited in the middle of the day. That was another thing that popped in. And so at 4 o'clock, the attendant, we said we want to keep it quiet because it would be too much fanfare for them. And I had a mane of long hair, so it would have just been too much of everybody. So then the attendant came to us and said, okay, now go to the teacher's house, which was empty. Chidam Rinpoche was at a puja. And he said, and now cut your hair and you can get dressed. And we told one nun who brought robes for me, because I didn't have a set of robes or anything. And then, so now we're stuck in the house with shaved heads and, you know, and we couldn't go, and we didn't want to go anywhere until the ceremony and have everybody kind of, you know, but right in front of the house, they're setting up for the fire ceremony. A number of our close friends. So finally, at one point, I said to Brian, I can't stay here. We have all this stuff organized. I need to go out. Like, I don't know when they'll be ready. So we decided to both go out, and we're walking down the steps of the house, the teacher's house. And then our friends from the fire puja, somebody looks up and they see these two bald-headed, you know, shaved-headed people. And so Brian had already shaved his head many times, so he was recognizable. But for me, when you go from like a lot of hair, I looked totally different. And so one guy is looking, and they're all working here, but he looks up and he sees Brian, but he can't figure out who's with Brian that's in robes. And then he recognized me, and all of a sudden he screams, it's Amy! And they all look up, and then they all screamed, and they were running over to us. You know, it was very sweet. And then we walked over to the stupa, and there was a lot of people there, a few hundred people. And then there was this noticeable gasp when I turned up with no hair at the stupa. And then they just did a short haircutting naming ceremony, because they didn't have time to do the ordination, and then the ordination was a few days later. So, sorry, that's the long story of what happened. But it was a great moment. Very fortunate, and fortunate that I've lasted, because of those nine people that ordained. Of the nine people that ordained, only two of us are left ordained right now of the nine, and one passed away, and the rest gave back their robes. Yeah. Which happens sometimes for Westerners. It's hard to be a nun in the West because there's not a lot of support. So,
what was the date?
So the date was, the ordination, I believe, was the 26th of June, and Sakadawa was the 20th of June, 2000.
2000. I'm trying to think where I was then, because I was at Vajrapani a lot.
You came a lot to Vajrapani, where I met you. Yeah.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah, yeah, I loved when you guys came.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Can I say something else?
Please.
So we were talking about Tonglen yesterday, and can you hear me? We were talking about Tonglen, and something came into my memory about when I first learned about Tonglen when I was working at the Department of Health and going to Sechi Lin in San Francisco, and so I learned the technique, and I thought I would experiment, and I didn't believe it could possibly work. I had kind of like an enemy at work, somebody who was on my case. She was a bitch. I thought, I'm sure she thought
and
I was too.
An inherently existent one too, I'm sure, right? Yeah. For all time, yeah.
Yes, yes, she was tattling on me and writing me up, and we had a very difficult relationship, so I thought, well, I'm going to practice on her. So I
That's great.
I did,
yeah.
Yes.
Perfect person to practice on, yeah.
And I thought, well, this is never going to work, of course. And I did the whole, you know, what I had learned about the breathing and the light coming in and out, and the next day or the day after, all of a sudden she's in my office hanging out and wanting to gossip and chat. And I was really shocked that all of a sudden she's so friendly, and I couldn't believe it. And then I couldn't get rid of her. She wouldn't leave.
You know, it really does work. I've done this with people where I'm really struggling with somebody. You know, and Buddhist centers, you know, it's not like everything's peaceful at Buddhist centers as well. But it was we had, you know, one coworker, and you try all the external things. You meet directly and you get a mediator. You know, we tried to really, she wasn't a bad person, but it just was some old karma. It was unbelievable. And so sometimes the only thing I could do was Tonglen privately in my own room and then I'd come out and it would ease. Something was eased between us. It was so amazing. I was really like, huh. Like it obviously does something. Not that we see what's going on, but it does seem to have a very profound effect of releasing others from suffering, offering them happiness like that. Yes, so Tonglen meditation is more of a higher level practice, giving and taking, giving and taking. But you first are taking, and what you're taking just in through visualization is others' suffering. You know, and then what I'm offering is all my happiness and goodness. And so people normally are like, what? You know, what? The suffering doesn't harm you, but you can imagine a constricted knot of your selfishness kind of at your core, you know, and that's what I'm diminishing every time I breathe in the suffering from someone else, breathe it in. And you can also do Tonglen with yourself across from you and take the suffering that you're experiencing with this coworker and offer. But it's nice when you do put the difficult person in front of you. And at first it's hard to do because you're like, I don't want their suffering. They're a jerk. But you have to kind of push through that because that's ordinary thinking. And ordinary thinking keeps us mired in negative patterns in our mind. What we're looking at is extraordinary thinking, like more like a Buddha thinking, omniscient thinking. And it really seems to have an effect. So you can take it in any images that represent suffering to you, and you can offer with any images that represent happiness for you, mounted on the breath. Because you're breathing anyway. Why not use your breath for something positive then? Like that. You can do it any time.
There's a question in the back he's been waiting patiently. What?
Hello. I'd like to, I wanted to ask a question yesterday, and if it's pertinent, you spoke some, and I've heard Geshe-la say, he talks about living in today as if it were a dream. Like a dream. And you seem to put emphasis on like, that's like a dream. And I just wondered if you could expand on that a little bit. I'm not asking for advice.
Sure. Yes. Like when I was saying yesterday, if you're a child of a child in between your meditation times, or be a child, one of the slogans of mind training, be a child of illusion, which is like, see everything like a dream. The reason I add the like is if you see everything as a dream, then, you know, I can step in front of the bus because it's a dream. But if it's like a dream, you have to practically engage to know I can't harm myself or step in front of this speeding car because I'll get killed. But I can also see the speeding car instead of getting annoyed with them. Why are they speeding down this road? Like that, it's kind of like, it's just like a dream. It's not, I don't have to attach any more importance to it than I can. So sometimes we have problems that arise. And when they arise, we devote more and more mental energy in a negative way to them that solidifies them. Not helpful. So if you can, it's about lightening up a little bit and seeing everything in that kind of dreamlike basis.
Hello. I had another question about the Tonglen meditation, about taking on others' negative actions and suffering. I was having a hard time trying to imagine that. Could you explain a little bit more how exactly you can do that in meditation?
Sure. I'll give you, for instance, this person I was working with at one center, I found very challenging. And, you know, we kind of went through, you know, her bad relationship with her mother was horrible. And she was already in her 40s when you'd hope that you'd make some strides with it. And her mother was still alive. And so I got to be the evil mother for her. And I one time confronted her about it and said, do you think you're kind of viewing me? And she said, she owned it. She said, yeah, probably. You know, that. So we had some old karma as well. And so I put her in front of me. And I thought if she hasn't kind of been able to deal with this difficult thing with her mother, she also had gotten a very serious illness that I think was related to that, but I can't say, I don't know. But she had some real difficulties, I think, going through space. So I could see that as suffering. And then I could put the suffering into whatever images I wanted to make that, whether it's colored light rays or words, you know, of things that she had kind of hurled at me and things. And so I would just, as I'm inhaling, take that in those visualizations, let it chip away at my own selfishness, you know, that was seeing me as too important and whatever that would get in the way. Let that diminish, and then I'm in a space freer, lighter, you know, happier. And let me offer her all happy moments and all resolution of difficult relationships and whatever she wanted, good health. And it made me happier just doing that, in whatever images represent that to me. And I noticed just the process of, you have an enemy. What if you wish them well? It's totally adverse thinking. This is what mind training is. Totally the last thing that the United States of America would say. You have an enemy and you're going to wish them well. Okay, but this is what undoes the harm. This is the catch that I find unique, you know, to a lot of spiritualities. That is the thing, is we have to really love, find a way to love other people. I'll put it this way to not make it so woo-woo, but create healthy relationships with others, especially those we label as enemy. Because then the enemy goes away. You know? Like once you become friends with them, that woman didn't bother you anymore, except that she's hanging out in your office too much. But they don't bother you the way they were, where suddenly she's really difficult. Like, I don't want to see her. It's like that. And it really does shift like that. It's amazing to ever have a positive thought about somebody you view as difficult. Okay? This is radical. This is radical work. And this is why it's higher level practice. Because most people are like, this person harmed us. It harmed my family. Harmed my kid. Now, it doesn't mean you don't keep protecting your family and your kids. Be wise. But for you to continue to hate out there, it only keeps you prisoner. The person may have even died. And you're still... So you have to check your own mind experience. How does the mind-heart experience feel? Because I'd like to continue to hate that person and call them a bitch or whatever you want to call them, like that. But if I can start to just say, well, they must be suffering if they cause this harm. They must be suffering. Boy, I really wish they were free of the suffering. Just if you have that thought go out, just really wish they were free of the suffering. Terrorists in the world, I wish they were free of suffering. If they weren't suffering, they wouldn't be terrorists, most probably. If they were happy all the time, they wouldn't be terrorists. But they're not happy. So does that help a little bit?
Yes, thank you.
It's not easy. It's not easy. It is radical. I find a radical approach, which is why we normally teach it higher level, but it's essential for us now. It's your choice. You can keep hating people and keep promoting divisiveness. And had a really interesting conversation with somebody yesterday about us and them. You know, do you ever have they're doing it? You know, do you have this? I used to say to my mother she was great. She'd say to my sister and I something about clothes, and then she's like, oh, well, you know, they're not wearing that anymore. And my sister and I would go, who are they? The they? You know, is it the they that are... So this person got into a thing and didn't want to name names about something going on with inner life that... And so she kept saying, but then they said... So then I'm like, who are they? Who's the they? Because they becomes they. T-H-E, it's huge. They. But they is a human being. And it ends up that what she told me is they was a human being, one person, that I happen to know, who's got the same intention this other person has. It's not they. It's this person who's trying to do a job, who's probably overworked, whatever, you know, doing the best they can do. And, you know, so you can keep them out there, like, and then it's, so we think that it should be like this, but they said, it just creates duality. We're all in this together to make the planet harmonious. So I know some people are doing a little bit more for that than others, but we're all in it together. And the more I want to divide and kind of say, okay, all you guys over there, you're not in my boat, you know, then it just creates a lot of imbalance on the planet, I think. So that's really our job. If you're in this path, if you're on a spiritual path of good heart, there are many. You don't have to be Buddhist. But if you're on a truly valid spiritual path with good heart, we have to create really reach across the span, especially to other, to somebody we see as other, like that.
Venerable Amy, in the teachings, we hear a lot of reference about precious human rebirth and how not to waste it. Is there a difference between precious human rebirth and just human rebirth?
Yep, because precious human rebirth indicates you've met the Dharma. There's a lot of humans on the planet that don't have a precious human rebirth. There's several countries, it's illegal to practice Dharma, to practice Buddhism, like Saudi Arabia. So you might be born there, and you might be a human, but not any way to get yourself out of the suffering permanently. Not a path like that, you know, unless that their belief system has that. But I don't think it does. That I haven't noticed from my own checking. Doesn't mean people there don't have good heart. Many of them do, and it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with Islam if that's what they practice. Because the essence of most of the religions I found on the planet. Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, many other things, most of them are promoting the good heart. The essence of those religions, honestly, is promoting kindness and love and things like that. What happens is when human nature gets a hold of certain of the religions and you get some dynamic leader that says, follow me, the human could be confused. If they're not enlightened, and they might start saying, you know, our path is to go to war and to kill these people, and you know, then I'd start questioning. Because if it adds any harm into anybody, I would be suspicious myself. That's my own path. Is I checked. You know, I was looking at different things at one point, and once it gets into harm, and if it also gets into where people aren't necessarily practicing authentically, I have questions about that myself. But you have to find your own way. Find many paths to the top of the mountain like that. But I really believe in the fundamental goodness of all beings. But human nature is flawed, so we make mistakes. And we have the wrong view, and then I say the wrong thing to somebody, and then that person gets upset. And that's, you know, we're trying our best. We're trying our best.
Hi, Venerable Amy.
Hi.
I have a grandmother that is suffering with Alzheimer's or wading through Alzheimer's. She's actually quite happy in a blissful state at the moment. And I have found it to be a very spiritual, rich time for me as well, because I at some point I stopped existing to her.
You stopped?
I stopped existing to her. She
okay.
stopped knowing who
she
I was.
She doesn't know who you are. Okay.
Right. So we just spend time together as friends. Usually she thinks I might be her sister.
Okay.
So that's kind of cool.
And you are in some way, in some life, you were sisters. Yeah,
right,
for sure.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So, again, there's a spiritual richness there. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about Alzheimer's and dementia as it's growing. Sometimes I feel like I might be in a rush to train my mind before I lose it, because Alzheimer's runs in my family. It might be a possibility. I'm not quite sure. If you had any thoughts about how it's becoming an issue in families, and how we might support people dealing with a loved one with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so sorry for what you're going through, you know, if it's difficult with her. However, one benefit is if she's in a very peaceful place, like you said, because sometimes with Alzheimer's, people are not, and they're agitated, and they have to be restrained and hospitalized. Like it's quite serious. So I have met a couple people where in their Alzheimer's and their dementia, being older, one of my friend's mothers as well, she was never really that nice of a person, and she's turned into a really nice person now. Like, it's been an incredible transformation of, I've seen this happen a few times. So it's nice that you still maintain a relationship. It doesn't matter if she knows you. I mean, it's a little sad on some level, but you're there. You're showing up. I don't know where the person, where the mind goes at that point. Like, how, what is their experience? I don't know what Buddhism really says about that, obviously, than just some karmic imprints where you're not going to be engaged as much with an accurate reality externally. I don't know what the internal experience is. You can purify anything. So even if it runs in your family and you purify the cause to have dementia later, you might not have it. You know, so there's purification practices, and I certainly hope you don't have to go through that. The other thing, I think the reason it's turning up more, I'm not really sure, but people are living longer than they did. So my parents, three of them died, two of them died in their 50s, and one, I think, in their early 60s. And that's very young now. So we wouldn't have known, had they gotten to be 70 or 80, would they have developed Alzheimer's, but we don't know because they died of cancer prior to that. So I think that's a reason, do you think, is why it's turning up so much now, that we're seeing more of it? People are living a long time. My dad at almost 92 in his assisted living center is one of the youngest, like is like a young in there in his place at 92. You can imagine. So I think it's just being there, like you're being there for her when you can, to make sure she's not in any agitated state as much as possible, she's comfortable. And then if you're yourself, you can do purification practices if you'd like, directed at that. Now, if you get a chance and you eventually have like a highly qualified teacher, you could ask them, someone like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, for practices for your life. And Rinpoche does give specific things for individuals that, and you get a whole computer printout of specific practices, and there'll be blank lines. So some of it he fills in, it's filled in just for you. But whether he's met you or not, he can do that. Like that.
Thank you.
There's someone here. Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask you if you can define what is the mind according to Buddhism.
Do you have a weekend?
No.
No, I'm joking. It would be helpful if, I believe they do Discovering Buddhism here at this center, which is a great, it takes you through the whole path, 14 modules. The first module is mind and its potential. It's one of my favorite modules to teach about the mind, but the mind is, in Tibetan Buddhism, to give you a brief overview, is a stream of thoughts, experiences, moments of consciousness, changing every moment, not physical, no shape, no color, no form. And it exists on a most subtle level, a subtle level, and a gross level. And the most subtle level is a clear light nature of mind that is what goes on to other rebirths, and that's what reincarnates. And it contains all of the imprints from past activities you've done with your body, speech, and mind, leaving karmic imprints that will ripen in the future, dictating what kind of life you'll have, like that. So it is a stream of, you know, mental experiences And then it has a way also of connecting with our sense faculties and the physical organs of those, which is how we take in information. The mind has two main qualities. It's clear and it's knowing. So it has a quality of clarity, this clear light nature, and it has a quality of awareness. That's your mind. That's it. So it's not clutter and it's not busyness and it's not fear and it's not depression. And those are just simply delusions that pass through the state based on previous habits of those in the mind. And we can get rid of those permanently from the mind. But you still have your personality like that for the most part. Yeah. So our tradition is a big, most of it is focused on the study of the mind. But Tibetan Buddhism would say everything comes from the mind. Your whole external reality is yours alone based on what imprints are in your mind. There's no God, the creator, something like that. Doesn't come from anybody else like that.
What did you mean by clarity? Clarity and knowledge. I know knowledge. What do you mean by clarity?
Clarity and awareness. Clarity and awareness. Yeah. So clarity, it's a clear light nature of the mind. The mind has a reflective quality like a mirror. And what's interesting is that's part of its, in its most subtle form, is this tremendously pure essence. And so if we remember that, every time you experience anger or depression or grasping, or if you can quickly remind yourself that that's not really the nature, the true nature of my mind, it's simply an unbalanced state that's there in ordinary human beings, and I can work to chip that away to come back to this pure essence of mind where everything, you're blissful, you're happy, and all the goodness can come from there. And you're merged with all of your good qualities fully manifest, like loving kindness, compassion, and all the good qualities, patience, things like that. Yeah. It's time. Is everybody okay? I'm sorry we didn't have longer, but I want to thank you so much for your attention. I'd like to dedicate whatever positive energy we've created, may it be helpful for you to find peace in your heart and mind, and to very much practice kindness from that experience as much as possible. Our planet needs us to be kind, be kinder. Can it also help us, if you're interested, to move along a path to full awakening, as then you're unlimited and benefiting all living beings? Thank you very, very much. I have a card if you're interested. I've got some teachings associated, and it's connected to a YouTube channel if that's helpful for you, where teachings are categorized by topic. Feel free to take a card. I've got a few left. There's also a pilgrimage I'm leading in May 2020 to Laudo, which is a remote retreat center near Mount Everest. We're going to do a three-day retreat there. I led one last year, last October. You can also talk to... I'm sorry, what's your name? Who went to Laudo?
Laura.
Laura's been there. She went on a pilgrimage with Venerable Rubina. You could ask her about it. It's to raise money for Laudo, but you'll be trekking in an amazing part of the world and doing, but it has a spiritual component. So if you're interested, you can, there'll be some information on my website soon. Yeah. Thank you very much.